welcome to a half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. This story comes from the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, August of 1962. The title is The Top, and it's written by George Sumner Elby. a.m. to Jonathan Gerber from L. Lester Leith. Read the pale green memorandum slip on the desk. Kindly save your day for me. Attached is an elevator pass for your permanent possession. Suggest you visit 13th floor this morning, but no higher. LLL. So, after all these years, said Jonathan to himself as he drew the pass, the first he had ever actually touched from its fascinating envelope, it was, of course, a miniature pyramid. One metal surface bore the firm name, Allied, the other a photo engraving of his, Jonathan's own head and shoulders. Now, when or where he had been photographed, he had no idea. Recently, it must have been, for he was wearing a tie he had just bought. Evidently, the company police had caught him with a fast lens as he entered or left the building. Miss Kindhands, he spoke to his secretary over the intercom, cancel my appointments. Mr. Leith wants me to stand by. The golden pyramid in his hand, he strode down the lustrous corridor to the elevator bank. 13. The elevator operator, though he'd known his face and his fuzzy Harris tweed suit for years, faltered in alarm. Oh, it's all right, Jonathan assured him and turned over his hand to show the pass. Sure, said the man, and he breathed the two words as a musician might breathe two soft low notes on a flute. And then he came to attention, shut the bronze door, and pushed his button. 14 years. Or is it 16? Murmured Jonathan to himself, and descended, even as the elevator carried him upward in power and prestige, through the tiers of memory to his first days in the building. He recalled smiling how he had had his doubts about the elevators. As morning after morning they had lifted him to the advertising department on the 8th floor, he had felt against all reason that there was trickery, that he was being carried not up, but down, down, down into catacombs beneath Allied's gigantic pyramid. The little electric bulbs in the car, blinking 1 and 2 and 3, had not convinced him that he was traveling upward. The motion was so smooth, nothing could be felt. When the noiseless door opened, nobody could have said where he was. Long, empty corridors, narrow as the galleries of a mine, stretched away without end, their plastic panels gleaming under the light from squares of milk glass in the ceiling. There were no windows anywhere in the building, and the radiance entering through the glass brick might have come from deftly concealed electric lamps. There was nothing to prove it was daylight. Fantasy, Jonathan had rebuked himself. Fantasy, I'm lucky, phenomenally lucky. Here I am, only 27, at Allied. Anybody else would give his eye teeth to be where I am. Nowadays, he used colloquialisms to capture more readers for his ads, but in the past, he had used them innocently for pleasure. He had been a copywriter in a New York advertising agency when one afternoon, the firm's senior partners had called him in and told him that the almost legendary firm in Minnesota wanted to hire him. If Jonathan refused the paltry gift of himself, it had been made clear the agency might henceforth find it embarrassing to employ him, and so might other agencies. So, feeling like an Aztec youth chosen for the stone altar, honored but doubtful, he had taken the train for Minnesota, finding chocolates and crimson roses in the stateroom. Oh, there had been qualms, nor had his first impression of L. Lester Leith been reassuring. Leith's soundproof office, with its pale gray paint and pale gray furniture, its glass brick glowing with a dim light that might be sunshine and might not, had been rather like a bank of fog. And it had been difficult to tell where the fog left off and Leith himself began. His face was the color of mist. His hair might have been aluminum on which moisture had condensed. His white fingers had moved across his desk like small wraiths, while his voice had the soft, mournful boom of a deep-toned steamer whistle heard across miles of veiled sea. It had taken Jonathan a while to become accustomed to Leith's voice and its miracles of misty circumlocution. What will my job be? He had asked, and Leith had replied that jobs were for the lowly and words were not to be used inaccurately. I mean, what will my work be? Jonathan had corrected himself, and Leith had answered, work. Ah, work. It was work which made the fathers of our nation giants on the land. It was work which made America what it is today, the light and beacon of a troubled world. People have grown soft. They ask for security. Ah, the best security, the only security, is work. A third time, Jonathan had tried, and Leith had said, what products will you advertise? My boy, Allied has no products. Let us say rather that Allied creates and develops semi-finished materials which enable small manufacturers under the free enterprise system to enrich or otherwise improve certain items for the ultimate benefit of the consumer, Mr. and Mrs. America. Your subject will be Allied itself. I have brought you to us because, well, you have a nice flair for words. I was deeply stirred by your headline for the shotgun ad, A Lad and His Dog. And the little piece you wrote for the diaper people. What did you call it? Oh, yes, Babies Are Fallen Stars. Just give me words like that for Allied, my boy. Give me patriotism, friendship, nobility, love. Thus 14 years ago. Could it be 16? Could it be 17? Jonathan had begun his task of writing for millions of newspaper readers. Little essays without subjects. When his first institutional copy appeared in print, he had feared that people would laugh. But nobody had laughed. On the contrary, letters of praise had come in from every corner of the country. His ad, which listed George Washington's virtues and named Allied as their modern inheritor, had won the National Advertising Council's Platinum and Ruby Medal. His ad stating that Allied conducted its business affairs according to precepts learned from a toil-worn mother's lips by Honest Abe Lincoln had been singled out for a special scroll by the Junior Chamber of Commerce. Ever since, he had been writing such pieces with a growing appreciation of their worth, eloquence, and dignity. And meanwhile, L. Lester Leith had shown him only admiration and kindliness. And Allied had raised his salary from $10,000 a year to $17,500 and from $17,500 to $23,200. Each year, he was awarded, in addition, a bonus of Class C preferred stock, which he would forfeit only if he left the company before retirement age. He was expected on the 13th floor, a burly young guard in a gray uniform, no doubt a recruit from the college football squad, saluted him.
Mr. Gerber, I'm going to show you anything you want to see around here.
I really don't know what I want to see, I'm afraid. This is my first visit.
Mr. Lee said you might like me to introduce you to the divisional manager, sir.
Well, then let's do that, by all means. The guard marched ahead, opening bronze doors. In 15 divisional office suites, Jonathan shook hands with 8 bald thin men and 7 bald fat men. And these were not the directors. These were merely the decision and risk takers, devoted family men who were paid $100,000 a year and died early of coronary attacks. Jonathan inspected their graph room, their elaborate communications room, their restaurant, their small 3-bed hospital. I see the hospital has its own elevator, he observed to the guard. If a man dies at his desk, you can get him out of the building without anybody getting so much as a peek at him.
Well, the planning board doesn't slip up on the many details, sir.
And Jonathan, in his 4th or 5th year with the company, had a personal encounter with Allied's precision technique for just such fatalities. One day in the elevator, an engineer named Jax had paled, gasped, and fallen. And while Jonathan knelt over him, the operator had stopped the car between floors, telephoning calmly to the starter in the lobby for instructions. Then the cage had dropped fast and deep into the cellars, and guards with a stretcher had met it. And Jonathan had said, I'm afraid he's dead. And the chief guard had replied, Oh, no, sir, he's fainted, that's all, or else he's indisposed. You're going to get him to a doctor? And the chief had said, Just step back into the car, sir. That had been all there was to it. Later, Jonathan had been unable to pry an unequivocal answer from the elevator operator, from the guards, or from anybody. On the obituary page of the newspaper on the third day, there had been a brief paragraph to the effect that one D.M. Jax, engineer of this city, had passed away. But not so much as a word had indicated that the man worked for Allied. Jax had simply disappeared. The company did not ignore death. It bypassed it. When a man died, his assistant took his place in a corporation with tens of thousands of employees. Somebody was bound to die every day. And work couldn't be repeatedly interrupted. Back once more on his own floors, Jonathan put his head into Leith's handsomely decorated anteroom and said, "If he wants me, I'm back."
"The doctor is with him now,"
said Miss Tabline, Leith's confidential secretary.
"But stay near your phone, please."
At his desk, with nothing to do but wait and stare at the reader acceptance graphs on the wall, Jonathan asked himself what could be in the wind. Leith was anything but impulsive. The permanent pass, the visit to 13, were in themselves a promotion. Nothing lay above 13 but 14, since nobody at all was permitted to go up to 15, where the president's suite filled the pyramid's tip. Was he, Jonathan wondered, actually to join the planning board? He could rise no higher in the advertising department without taking Leith's own job. Well, he would have the answer soon enough, he told himself, whatever it might be. With a shrug, he took the pass from his pocket, scrutinized his likeness on it, and laughed. Gone. Gone were the waxen curls of youth. In reminiscent sentimental mood, he tried to recall how he had looked at 27, and he couldn't manage it. "But I do remember," he said to himself with a smile. "I do remember that I was skeptical. Oh, was I skeptical?" He had, he remembered, in his suspicion of the elevators, actually paced off the corridors to make sure the lower floors of the pyramid were broader than the upper. In fact, he had done worse than that. He had played truant from his desk to explore the cellars, finding, of course, nothing evil, finding nothing at all. Then, Jonathan recalled, smiling, having learned what he could about the building, he had tried to discover what Allied's products were. Flair for words or not, it had seemed absurd to him at first to write ads without knowing what they were about. And he had been able to learn a little. He had found, for example, that the company's 4,000 products bore alphabetic names ranging from AB, A-A-B, an adulterant for milkshakes, to ZYZ, Z-Y-Z, which were rotors for tractor magnetos. But his collection of OBS and ZYZs had soon bored him. The buzzer on his desk, tuned to G-sharp, sounded. With the dexterity of practice, Jonathan lifted his telephone from its cradle and perched it like a parakeet on his shoulder. "Gerber here." It was Leith's secretary.
The doctor is still with him. His ulcers must be unusually bad this morning, or maybe he's been hearing the ticking again. But I have some instructions for you. Kindly have your lunch, make a tour of 14 at 1 o'clock, and report back here at 2.
What's cooking, Miss Tabline? Jonathan asked her. The secretaries regarded slang as evidence of democracy and passed the word around that you were adorable if you used it. A girl worked away her fingernails in her youth for a boss who was sufficiently adorable.
I don't know. It must be important, though. A major project.
I eat my lunch at 12 with the junior executive group, you know. The directors don't go out to lunch till 1:15. If I go up to 14 while they're out, the place will be deserted. What does he want me to do up there, do you know, Miss Tabline?
Just look around, I guess. I wish I was going with you, Mr. Gerber. Promise me one thing, though. Promise me when you get back, you'll tell me if Mr. Waffen really has a gold-plated toilet seat.
Yes, I will, promised Jonathan, but he knew he wouldn't tell. He ate lunch with two of his assistants, younger men still in their indoctrination period. The Grapevine Telegraph, he discovered to his amusement, had already tapped out the news of his golden pass. The boys showed him scrubbed, bright, eager faces, and they writhed each time he opened his mouth, out of respect. Shortly after 1, he rode up to 14 in the elevator. It was noticeably smaller than 13. Evidently, the step back was sharper than it appeared from the street. Another guard, saluting, informed him that there were 8 directors' offices and a conference room, and that he was free to go anywhere he liked. And the guard said, "They're worth seeing, sir." And they were. Several offices had barber chairs, gigantic television receivers, and bars stocked with private blends. One had a cigar humidor the size of a bank vault. One a target range for air pistols. One a finished sauna bath. The most interesting was a room which duplicated the after deck of a cabin cruiser, complete with angling chair and a rack for rods and reels. Not an assistant, not a secretary was to be seen. Not a memorandum desecrated the rich, polished wood of the vast desks. Tell me, Jonathan said to the guard, how often do these planning board men come in? And the guard had replied. Well, they're here for the annual meeting, sir. Otherwise, they come in only when Mr. Satterthwaite sends for them, I guess. Anscombe Ludlow Satterthwaite II was Allied's president, who had his suite in the point of the pyramid, and a man who was photographed, growing no older in the photographs from year to year, but he was never seen. Do any of them live in Minnesota? Forgive my curiosity. This is my first visit. Well, sir, you're forgetting they all have planes and pilots nowadays. Like Mr. Eppinger, he's got 400,000 acres in Louisiana. He keeps for the shrimping, so he lives there. And Mr. Latchwell owns an island off the coast of Mexico. He's got a castle and a little army. That's why he wears his red and blue uniforms and his leather boots with the stars on them. Yeah, I've seen Mr. Latchwell on the elevators, of course. Jonathan, at one time or another, had glimpsed most of the portly, imposing directors. There was one, undoubtedly the fisherman, who wore white canvas trousers and a white cap with a green celluloid bill. Another went bare-toed in rawhide sandals for his health. There was method behind their little eccentricities, of course. They put them on as a demonstration of equality, as wise old Leith had patiently explained to him more than once. Thanking the guard, Jonathan went down again. It's 1:55, he said, putting his bald head into Leith's anteroom. Miss Tabline, peering over her glasses, said,
Oh, come in and wait here. Tell me, you must tell me. Is it really?
Our directors work much too hard, Miss Tabline, for any such nonsense. But, of course, I understand you were just having a little fun.
Oh, I did so want to know.
Was Miss Tabline's loyalty questionable? She might just possibly, said Jonathan to himself, prove to be a dangerous fellow worker. He read Dear Folks, the Allied house organ, until the signal lamp flashed and Miss Tabline said he might go in. Good news or bad, and he scarcely saw how it could be bad. He would have it now.
Well, good afternoon, my son, said L. Lester Leith.
His face was as white as a sheet of the Yaga, the company manufactured as an intermediate for the dentifrice industry, and smudged with shadow. One corner of his mouth sagged. His left eye was an owl's, a pupil enormous and fierce. Jonathan was shocked and said, Lester, you're ill.
I'm not ill. I'm dying. I'll die at my desk this afternoon, probably within the next 5 or 10 minutes.
Well, let me drive you home.
No, I want it this way. I want my death as well as my life to be a demonstration of service to Allied and all that it stands for. But time is short, my son. Tomorrow morning, an inter-office memo, Form 114B Blue, will announce that you are succeeding me as chief of the department. You'll start at 50,000. Your stock bonus will be comparable.
Well, thank you, Lester.
Your first act of office, Jonathan, I hope, will be to hire an assistant who blazes with our sacred fire. I suggest that you do what I did. Comb the agencies for a young Jonathan Gerber and train him as for 21 years I have trained you.
It was a gray afternoon. No sunlight at all was filtering through the glass brick. The room, it seemed to Jonathan, was crowded with bars of fog lying one on top of another like 2x12 stacked in a lumber yard. In dimness, in shimmer and shadow, L. Lester Leith's face came and went, an image floating free in space, bobbling lazily like a barrel on a foggy sea. It's been such a joy to serve Allied that I haven't counted the years, said Jonathan. He had learned well. Such pronouncements were now effortless for him, but it was a bit of a blow nevertheless. Has it really been so long?
It has, my son. And I know I leave the department in good hands. Did you go up to 13?
Yes, of course.
14?
Of course, it was your order. Leith swayed. With an effort, he gathered together his failing energy. And he said,
Before you take over, there's one more thing, Jonathan. One final rite. You must meet our president. Go up to 15.
He sagged on his executive's posture chair. Jonathan sprang forward. Lester. Ever so slowly, Leith raised a white forefinger towards the ceiling.
15,
he whispered, and died. Tenderly, Jonathan closed behind him the soundproof door that was now his own. Miss Tabline, please call the janitor. Mr. Leith is no longer with Allied. Down the corridor at the elevator bank, a car appeared the instant he pressed the button, almost as if news of his eminence had somehow traveled down the dark shaft along the bell wire. And he directed the operator brusquely. The top. The little lamps blinked. The door slid open. But I said I wanted the top. Jonathan protested indignantly. He was the advertising manager. He earned $50,000 a year. His time was too valuable to Allied for him to permit a menial to waste it. And he said, this is 14, not 15. The operator said, sorry, sir, this is as high as we'll go. Speak to the guard. I will indeed. The guard was already at his elbow, the same chap who had conducted him earlier. What is this? What is this? I want 15, damn it. Oh, quite right, sir, over here. He led the way to a plain bronze door with neither knob nor keyhole. Just drop your pass into the slot, sir. It operates an electrical circuit and opens the door. You do the same thing on the other side when you come down. You mean to say Mr. Sathwaite walks this last flight each time he comes here? Well, I've never seen him, sir. He must. From coast to coast, hundreds of Allied plants were at work. 193,000 Allied fellow workers were turning out 4,000 products. Here, at the center of the country, sat this colossal pyramid, which was the center of the whole thing. Here, on the topmost floor of the pyramid, clicked the mind which in its genius comprehended and guided all. And here was he, Jonathan Gerber, about to shake the hand of supremacy. Eyes alight, shoulders squared, Jonathan dropped his pass into the thin slot, walked through the door, and shut it after him. Facing him was a simple staircase of painted steel with a handrail. Climbing it past rough walls of orange hollow tile which had not been plastered, he marveled. How fitting that Mr. Satherwaite, with his immeasurable power, should despise its trappings. Many and many a time in his writings, Jonathan had said that Allied's president was a simple man, and as always, the fiction had created the fact. He was. At the top of the staircase, he stepped onto a bare concrete floor littered with scraps of building paper, pots of dried paint, and dead flies. The air smelt like a Stilton cheese. Trying the door at his left, he peered into a black cavern in which greased steel elevator cables slipped over great spoked wheels. He tried a door at his right and gazed into another cavern exactly like it. For 5 minutes, for 10, he stood in the musty heat, turning slowly round and round, looking for he knew not what. A secret door, a cache, a blackboard on which his predecessors might have left, if nothing more, at least their signatures. But he saw only the paint pots, the flies, and four small windows like round eyes, one in each inward sloping wall. Cobwebs and grime covered the windows, but here and there on them he saw the scurf had been rubbed away as by a sleeved elbow. Stepping to the nearest, he broadened the clear spot on it and looked out. He saw a segment of the town, which might have been a ramshackle clutter of blackened boards, and beyond that, the endless plain of Minnesota. And he saw something he had forgotten, that it was winter on the prairie. Dry snow driven by the wind smoked over farmhouses and fences. Where the land could be seen at all, it was blue with cold, and more snow was coming, and more cold. For it was true that summer was a vacation, an interlude. Winter was the reality, a constant companion. Winter lay ever a few miles to the north, waiting to reclaim its property. Blue lay the earth, veined with white like the deep sea, and the veins were ice. Jonathan murmured and shivered, "So cold, so cold." And slapping the dust from his warm, fuzzy tweed suit, he summoned his raiment for his face, awe and dedication in the proper proportions, and tramped down the staircase, his heels ringing on the painted steel, bits of plaster gritty as sand beneath his soul. His hand all the way cherished the safety rail. He warned himself cautiously. This would be no time to slip and fall. No, I mustn't slip now. The title of that story is The Top. Written by George Sumner Elby, it appeared in the August 1962 edition of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is Michael Hansen speaking. Technical production on MindWebs by Steve Gordon. MindWebs comes to you from WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.